Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe, with a heavy emphasis on theater this week. I'll be talking with Matt Chapman and Deborah Eliezer. They're involved with Fool's Fury Factory Festival of Ensemble Theater. They'll be sharing some details about the visiting companies from L.A., New York, Chicago, and the Bay Area. Sammy Wiegent talks about Speechless Live, an improvised PowerPoint presentation spoof that's at Public Works. Also have a conversation with Terry Baum, star of Hick, A Love Story, the romance of Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt. Plus, being the first Thursday of the month, critic Joshua Cosman of The Chronicle will stop by to share his classical music picks for the month ahead. Stay with us. Fool's Fury, which San Francisco Arts Monthly called one of the brightest stars of the San Francisco experimental theater scene, will be presenting its fifth Fury Factory Festival of Ensemble Theater from July 6th to 20th, 2014. That itself is a tongue twister, let alone the dates. Since its inception in 2005, Fury Factory has presented works of more than 60 companies from around the United States and beyond, initiated by Fool's Fury founder and co-artistic director Ben Yalom in an effort to foster a sense of community and share ideas within the widely disparate world of ensemble theater. The festival has evolved to encompass a series of main stage performances and a series of works in progress. His co-artistic director, Deborah Eliezer, joins me in studio today along with performer Matt Chapman to talk about this year's offerings, which include 9 main stage shows and 15 works in progress. Matt, Deborah, welcome to Open Air.
Hey, thank David. You. Thanks for having us.
So perhaps, Deborah, you could take us first back to 2005 and the inception of the whole idea.
Ah, way back. Yeah. So, you know, we consider ourselves we saw a need that for San Francisco that we wanted to shine a light on amazing works both here in San Francisco and also across the nation and even internationally, because we've had companies from Afghanistan and London, England as well. We saw the need to really shine a light, bring some attention to these types of companies who are working together over a long period of time to create really interesting work to San Francisco audiences. So that's why we created the festival. Let's get together all of these different ensembles and show San Francisco this amazing work.
So are these companies and these productions coming to you, or are you seeking them out, or is kind of at this point a combination? People know
it's a combination. It's an application process, of course, and we always have to turn away some folks, and sadly. But the curatorial process is part of what we do with Fool's Fury to create the best festival that we think will be the most exciting for our audiences.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump forward to this year. Where did you grab ensemble from?
You know, there's people from always locally. We have a strong local representation. We also have people from Chicago, New York, Atlanta, Georgia, coming to us from all over the nation. So that's really exciting. We have 9 main stage productions, and one of them is Matt Chapman's company, Under the Table, who has been in the festival multiple times.
That's true. Repeat offenders.
Yeah. And does amazing clown-based physical work that I'll let Matt talk about. Fool's Fury itself, we always also, we're also creators as well as presenters. So we actually have 2 offerings in the Work in Progress series as well.
You've also gone far afield to England to draw on your talents.
Yes, we've had company from England and also from Afghanistan. Bond Street Theater was from New York, was collaborating with these fabulous Afghani actors, and they brought a wonderful production to us in 2009.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, tell us about your particular involvement this year.
Well, my ensemble's based in Brooklyn, although I've just relocated to Oakland, so this is all fresh.
I'm former Brooklyn boy myself. Okay. 15 years in Park Slope.
So. Okay. That's pretty good. I was there for about 8, and then I moved out back to California. I've been living the past few years in Humboldt County, working and teaching at Del Arte International School of Physical Theater up there. And my ensemble, which is still based there in Brooklyn, now is coming back to the festival for our third appearance. I want to say that we were in the first year, 2005, with a piece of ours called Solo, a two-person show. We returned in 2009 with a trio, The Only Friends We Have. And this year we're performing this piece we've been touring for the past few years called The Hunchbacks of Notre Dame, which is, again, a trio, same trio. We play a trio of sibling hunchbacks in a theater company who are trying to tell Hugo's story. And it's a play about what normalness is and notions of beauty and how we pressure ourselves and each other to change, to be lovable. And also it has more, it's like that but with more confetti.
Uh-huh. And it is a comedy.
It's a musical comedy.
Musical comedy.
Yeah, right. I'm laughing because everything that Under the Table does has a very twisted yet amusing and entertaining yet gets you right where you live kind of experience. That has been my experience.
That's
I'm really
sweet.
Looking forward to it.
That's sweet. We push for humanity, and we do it through comedy.
Mm-hmm. And you perform the same work in Brooklyn as well?
This piece we haven't played in Brooklyn, but we've toured it a lot. We've played this across Canada in a number of places at a few universities in the U.S. We played it just this winter. We played in Mexico City at a big festival there, which was great. We played with Supertitles.
Fun.
Yeah, yeah. It was really fun. We had the opportunity to work with a really great translator who's also a comedian, and she helped us to make sure that the punchlines didn't get delivered to the audience before we delivered them.
Well, there's that, yeah.
I mean, that's a big deal.
And that's the translation. Nothing's lost in translation.
Right. I mean, it's physical comedy, but we're really verbal as well. So.
You know, I think this really represents a lot of what why we bring all of these companies to San Francisco. You know, San Francisco itself, I think we were talking before we got on air, it's a really place of invention and reinvention. And definitely San Francisco theater, this is what we do. And that's why we're bringing 23 performances, 23 companies from all over the nation to come and in 2 weeks in 4 different venues, you know, rock San Francisco's Mission District in just in one block. It's the Arto Complex. So, you know, we're also drawing attention to this beautiful location that has so many theaters in it, the Arto Complex, the longest live-work loft, oldest in San Francisco, and the many artists and theater spaces that are there. And so you just walk from one theater to another, just one around the corner or, you know, a couple blocks to Joe Good Annex, and there you are. And you've got a host of exciting new work using, you know, like what Under the Tables, multidisciplinary, cutting-edge works. You can get clown shows. There's these wonderful, the submarine show.
Those guys are great.
And then, which is family-friendly work or interdisciplinary work, multimedia work from New York with Wax Factory, and then everything in between, you know.
It is a great venue, sure.
If I can say, just as an artist, to say, you know, this... The field of ensemble theater, which has been swelling internationally, but in particular in the U.S. for the past decades, it's a big part of what's going on in the creative edge of American theater, and it's really important that festivals like this exist. There aren't really other festivals of ensemble theater going on in the United States that I know of. I mean, there aren't really a lot of theater festivals in the United States. There are a few, but for a theater-making contingent as large as a country as large as the United States has, you know, there's not a lot of representation or a lot of inroads for a lot of companies without really substantial resources to access. So, you know, Canada has the Fringe, right. circuit, for example. And San Francisco has a part of that circuit, but it's not the same thing as having like a national or regional touring circuit that people can sustain themselves mm-hmm. off of. So things like this are critical, you know, and for it to have been existing as long as it has and to continue, it's really important.
Thanks for saying that. I think that's why we're doing this. It is important for people to understand that there's no other festival like this in San Francisco or on, you know, in our region. So that's why we really consider ourselves this hub of ensemble theater making. And really what that means is that when you come as an audience member, you're going to get really interesting new works of art that are being created and a way of looking at theater that you may not have already understood or seen. So if you're not real usually like a normal theater goer, this could be the really great opportunity for you to kind of get in and check something out because there's something for everyone. Or if you really love theater, you're going to see and notice that the way that we are perceiving and using the theater is something maybe that you've never experienced before.
That's Deborah Eleazar, who is the co-artistic director of Fool's Fury. Their festival runs through the 20th. It sounds like so many interesting things are going on. We haven't talked much about the workshops that are going on as well.
Yeah, there's two workshops.
Involved in.
Yeah, from Pig Iron, Quinn Boriedel is coming for a two-day workshop. We also have a clown workshop with the folks from Jaron Aviv and Slater Penny. These are Cirque du Soleil-level clowns. Anyone can take this workshop. It's a three-hour workshop. Also of note, David, is that tickets are $16. They're just $16. And so it's affordable and accessible to everyone. And we have great 3-show pass and 5-show passes. So that really makes it a fun experience for everybody.
Well, Matt Chapman, I wish you the best with your ensemble as well.
Thank you very much.
The Under the Table Ensemble, now bi-coastal ensemble that you have.
Yeah. Truly.
And your fellow actors are for the Hunchback Show, or who?
It's Josh Matthews and Sarah Peterseal.
Oh, fantastic. So,
great comedians.
Look forward to seeing them. And again, the full schedule of everything that's happening in this very, very concentrated period for Fool's Fury is at their website, foolsfury.org. Do check it out. Something for everyone is not an exaggeration when one says that. Deborah and Matt, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much, David.
Well, also on the theater front, you're in for a treat if you like your theater heavy on the snark. Some irreverent underground entertainment is underway this month and next through the folks that put on Speechless. Created by Sammy Wiegand and produced by Scott Lifton, you're in for an interesting evening where players are put on the spot with nothing more than a stage, a microphone, and a PowerPoint deck of images that they've never seen before. So the result can be quite interesting to behold, to say the least. Sammy Wiegand is senior game writer and narrative designer for Zynga, where he recently helped launch Farmville 2, Country Escape for iOS and Android. Wiegand is also an actor, comedian, writer, developer, director, producer, and teacher, and it's a pleasure for him to join me now, I hope, to join me here in studio to talk about Speechless.
Well, thanks for having me, David.
Sure, Sammy. It sounds like such an interesting idea. How did he come up with the idea originally?
Well, I think the original idea was being at my job that I've had for the past few years, watching a lot of boring PowerPoint presentations.
We've all been there, I think.
And also the performer and creative in me just looking at all these presentations and thinking, is there a way to apply this to live performance? Or people, you know, there's a lot of multimedia theater, and I've actually done comedy and stand-up in a one-person show where I use PowerPoint presentations and slides in the background, and it was effective and very fun for me and I think for the audience. And I thought, there's got to be a way to combine these worlds. You know, there's so many bright and innovative people in the Bay Area and so many amazing comedians that have really strong opinions about the tech world in general. And I think it would be really fun to mingle them together and see what happens. What does it look like when a comedian pretends to act like they're giving a keynote at a big conference? And what does it look like when some entrepreneur gets up there and she shows off her sense of humor and kind of another side of her personality that maybe the people she works with aren't really quite used to or haven't seen before.
So in addition to these being for consumption by the public, these are often used as within a company to showcase some community building within the company.
Yeah, of course. We started it as a monthly show, and it's every third Thursday at Public Works in the Mission. And it's a mixture of entertainers, entrepreneurs, and audience members. We actually bring one person from the audience up to just do it. And they improvise PowerPoint presentations they've never seen before. So all the decks are things that me and the producers put together. And they spin a virtual wheel that was actually made by an engineer that I know. And we can put anything into it. And basically, it's different categories. And it's not all business-related, too. You know, we have things like a eulogy or a wedding toast or a sermon. Anything that's a speech that people probably have apprehension about doing, but we all have to do it. It's a rite of passage in your life. You get up there and you improvise it. But like you said, we actually do it at companies for different reasons. We have training that we do to help people be more comfortable on stage. You know, a lot of the people that we deal with, they have to give presentations. It's a huge part of their job, but they're not performers. They're not entertainers. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing when they get up there. They just know that they were told that they have to, and it's a big part of pitching products and making sales and getting the big brand message out at big keynote addresses at conferences and things like that. And so we just try to loosen them up, and everything that we do is through kind of what I've considered my life philosophy in a lot of respects, all the rules of improvisation. Improvisation is the core of everything that I think I've done over the past 15 years, and it's the core of what Speechless is. It's the idea of go against all of your instincts of what you think a presentation should be. Try not to script it so much. Try not to over-rehearse it. Don't be attempting to be perfect, and don't be afraid to fail. And I think that's one of the cool things about the show is that we get everyday people up there, and they do something they've never done before in a way that they never thought they could do it. And they come away, you know, at least having a good time. And hopefully a lot of the times they feel empowered by the fact that they just did a presentation that they never knew they were going to do. They didn't know what it was going to be. They didn't know what the slides were. And they have this invigoration of, oh, my gosh, I just actually put myself out there for the first time and felt like the true version of myself. Because at work, and I see this all the time, and it was one of the reasons I created the show, you see people put this little protective shell around themselves when they're in this corporate environment. And clearly there are restrictions and you shouldn't go too far off the deep end with subject matter and language, but you can still be entertaining. You can still be a great storyteller. You can still be funny and relatable and conversational. And improvising presentations, I think, really loosens people up and shows them that you just don't have to practice all day.
Right, right.
And it doesn't have to be perfect. And if you're trying to play it safe every single time, you're probably going to come off boring. You know, if you're being so safe that you're not taking any risks, what you do is actually not going to be interesting and universal and relatable to anyone.
I think we've all been at some sort of a PowerPoint presentation where all the person is doing is reading what is on every screen. It's like,
yeah,
you as an audience member are skimming ahead or working on your BlackBerry
of course.
Your personal device of choice. And,
yeah.
But this is tremendous because it involves the audience in a way that they're engaged.
Yes.
It's not just a matter of seeing the image. They're with the person that is creating the improvisation.
Exactly. That's what I've always loved about live theater and performance, the interactivity. The theater, you know, brings people together, and you're in the room with the performer at all times. And that's one of the things I've loved about improvisation. Improvisation needs the audience in order to happen. You know, we need a suggestion. We need somebody to actually come on stage and help us. And Speechless, for me, is just taking it to another level. It's just an extra layer with my experience at Zynga, you know, developing games with the teams I've been on. Where how can we make this a game? How can we make this fun? How can we get people to interact as much as possible? So with Speechless, you can volunteer and be in the show, but if you're someone that's shy and you don't want to get up there, you can actually contribute to the show in another way. You can make slides for us and email them to us at info@speechlesslive.com. We take audience members' slides. You can Photoshop stuff or just find images that you think would be fun. And the images could be funny pictures, you know, of a cat photoshopped, you know, into a weird situation with the president or something like that.
Or
it could just be a really boring
graph chart. Or
yeah,
something.
Exactly. So it's all over the map. But I think that's fun because you have a lot of people out there who are really creative, really funny, but they don't want to necessarily be on stage. And there's another way for them to participate. And we're just trying to find more and more ways every month for the show to be more interactive. And this month we're adding something that I think is going to be fun. If you buy your ticket online, after you purchase your ticket, a little box pops up where you can actually put in your badge title for your fictional Silicon Valley job title. Because, you know, that's a big thing out here. Everybody has these weird titles for their jobs. And we think that's another way to get people talking and creative, where you can put in your strange badge title and then you can pick that up at the door. And we have badges and lanyards, which are essentially our show programs, because that's kind of the corporate culture version of that.
Very clever.
So you wear it around your neck, you go out into the room to get a drink before you sit down, and everybody's reading each other's badges, and it becomes like this bizarro universe of a corporate networking event. So the show is poking fun at this entire world, but it's also building off of the same, you know, tentpole ideas that we see at these places. So it's strangely a satire and an homage at the same time. And it gets people to realize that these events, the real versions of them, actually could be fun, which is why I think we've been having a good time and some success so far with taking it to companies, because the company goes, you know what? We should just do this. This is just how this should be from now on.
And it's not just a matter of being a comedic approach. It's a matter of being spontaneous and being engaged with who you're talking to.
It's just personalizing everything and humanizing it. So many of these amazing companies out here make such amazing products, but they're very complicated. They're hard to simplify in language and in terms of concepting them and communicating those ideas. And that's what we're doing. We're making fun at how ridiculous this world is in terms of these apps that, you know, are ubiquitous and potentially irrational ideas that, you know, they're not quite things that anyone really needs, but they're out there and we'll put it on our phone. But at the same time, the people that are making these things are really, really smart and creative people. And so I like the idea of mixing those people with the people that I've known for years, these very amazingly talented actors and comedians and writers, and putting them into the same world is really fun, I think, because I think that's what San Francisco and Silicon Valley and the Bay Area are really about, is just innovation and creativity and taking big risks. And everybody's kind of compartmentalized, and I just want the show to be a way for those worlds to mingle, because they don't seem to mingle all that much, because, you know, a lot of the people that I know, because being performers, they don't have jobs. That's their job. And so therefore they don't have any point of reference for this other world except for consuming these websites and apps and products. And for the other side of the fence, these people that work at these companies that we go to, they don't know what it's like to be on stage and actually perform in a real show or a real comedy show. And so it's just fun to see them mixed together, because sometimes it's very unexpected. The person we pick out of the audience might be the funniest person in the room. And maybe it's because they're more used to giving presentations.
Right.
But it's just interesting to see them mingle.
That's Sammy Wiegent, creator of Speechless, on the third Thursday of each month at Public Works on Erie Street in San Francisco. Sammy, tell me one of the most surprising experiences you had as doing this in a corporate environment.
I think the most surprising experience actually just happened last week. We were honored to be a part of Google's conference, Google I.O., and we did an impromptu Speechless session on Thursday. It wasn't actually on the original agenda. They thought it'd be fun to kind of pop it up the day before and see what happened in terms of the conference attendees showing up. And we were very, very surprised to see this giant line outside of the session room. I thought they were there for something else. And we get in there, and the place is packed, and there's still people in line waiting to get in. And I think a lot of it had to do with the people that we had in the show, which were amazing friends of mine. Chad Haas is a Google developer. He works on Android, and he got us into the conference in general. But the presenters were amazing. The judges were amazing. But the biggest surprise was when we took the volunteer up on stage. It was a girl named Venu. She's a woman who is an engineer at a local company, and she just, you know, she volunteered. She wasn't incredibly eager, but she didn't seem to have a problem with getting up there. And when I asked her if she gave presentations all the time, because that's what I expect when someone walks up there, she said she had never, ever in her life given one. And I said, are you kidding? You are now giving your first presentation at Google I.O. in front of 600 people.
Wow.
And then she did amazingly well. She talked about how she had gotten some training during the day about how to kind of, you know, center herself and really stick the landing with giving a great talk and connecting to the audience. And it was just it was the epitome of what Speechless is on display. And, you know, I had a little to do with that. It was all about her and her being brave to get up there. But that's what's so great about improv, people's bravery. But she got up there and gave the first presentation of her entire life in front of a conference audience, and she killed. She was wonderful. She was charming. She was funny. And that's what I love about the show, is that I book some of my favorite people, comedians from all over the country and especially here locally, and they can sometimes be topped by just everyday Joe or Jane out in the audience, just because that person has a real passion for doing this particular strange medium of performance. And that's what it is. I think when you think of a PowerPoint presentation, I don't think a lot of people go, oh, well, that's an entertainment medium. Well, clearly it's not most of the time, because people aren't treating it as such. But Speechless is kind of turning it on its head and saying, if you're on stage, you're standing up talking to an audience, they're all seated and they're directly listening to you and being attentive, that's a show. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're in a conference room of five people or a conference of 500, you're a performer right now and you're doing a show. So what do you got?
I've always looked at those PowerPoint software is, you know, a little bit of information is a dangerous thing for some people, because they think they can suddenly do like these amazing things. It's like, really? I think you need to work on it just a little bit more.
Yeah.
Sammy, I forgot to mention in my introduction that you were a past winner of the Battle of the Bay comedy competition, and you still hold the title funniest person in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Tell us how you
very
got that.
Very much in quotes.
How did you get that title, even if it is in quotes?
Well, the reason that I got the title is that I won the competition. It was actually a pretty long time ago. But the competition went away right after that. So the Battle of the Bay used to be held at the San Jose Improv, and it was there for a handful of years, and it took a few months, I think. There was different rounds, and if I remember, there were over 100 local comedians and maybe some comedians from L.A. every year that would enter it. And it was kind of like the World Cup in a lot of ways. You just kept getting, you know, farther and farther down the line of, you know, going up against comedians and getting knocked out. And I won it that particular year, and you got the title of the funniest person in the Bay Area. And then the next year, they got rid of the competition. And so I am going to milk that thing forever and ever, even if it happened a long time ago.
You also do some teaching outside of the arena of the Speechless format, don't you?
Yeah. I've taught acting and stand-up comedy and writing at colleges and universities, and then I taught for the San Francisco Comedy College for a very long time. And I also do, you know, like you said, I do a lot of stuff corporate training-wise in the realm of the things that I've always done, but now Speechless kind of is absorbing a lot of that training. But yeah, I've always taught all the things that I know how to do, you know, acting and comedy.
And what corporate events are coming your way that are on the calendar already for you?
Well, the next big event, I think, is later this month. We're going to Walmart's headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. So we're very excited about that. I'm very, very honored to be doing these shows and trainings at these, you know, pretty well-known companies. We never thought in a year we would be at the likes of Google and Walmart, and I'm very excited because I think that the companies that we're dealing with and working with are really responding to what we're doing. And I think we've found a new, you know, Web 2.0 and Silicon Valley twist on something that a lot of people at companies, I think, roll their eyes about, the corporate team building. And, oh, we're going to do an improv session for a half day, or, oh, here comes this guy and he's going to roast our CEO. I think we've found a way to make corporate training and corporate comedy actually pretty fun and pretty funny and definitely interactive, because we get everybody involved as opposed to just stand up there and make the most obvious jokes about where you work.
Sammy Wiegent, creator of Speechless, which you can catch yourself at Public Works on the third Thursday of each month. Information at speechlesslive.com. And chances are, you go to that website, you might be able to talk Sammy into coming into your corporate environment for your own set of PowerPoint presentations. Sammy, thanks so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Of course, Speechless Live is the website for Speechless and more about Sammy Wiegent's work. Still to come on Open Air this week, Joshua Cosman will be with us to talk about his classical picks for the month of July. And, next we're going to have an interesting conversation with taking us back to the 30s or so. Most people are aware of the very public profile that the wife of Franklin Delano Roosevelt embraced. Eleanor Roosevelt was the longest-serving First Lady of the United States, holding the post from March 1933 to April 45 during her husband's four terms in office. A husband who was, by the way, her fifth cousin and had a well-known uncle named Teddy. President Harry Truman later called her the First Lady of the World in tribute to her human rights achievements. Now, though widely respected in her later years, Eleanor was a controversial first lady for her outspokenness, particularly her stance on racial issues. She was the first presidential spouse to hold press conferences, write a syndicated column for a newspaper, speak at a national convention. On a few occasions, she even clashed with her husband's policies, and she advocated for expanded roles not only for women in the workplace, but for the civil rights of African Americans and Asian Americans, and the rights of World War II refugees. Even after her husband's death, Eleanor remained active in politics for the rest of her life. She pressed the United States to join and support the United Nations, became one of its first delegates, in fact. She served as the first chair of the UN Commission on Human Rights and oversaw the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Later, she chaired the John F. Kennedy administration's Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. So we know quite a bit about this very public figure. And while we also now know of the other women in Franklin's life for many years, Lucy Mercer among them, we don't know that much about the other woman in Eleanor's life. Lorena Hickok, the most famous woman journalist of the 1920s and 30s, and the first woman to get a byline on the front page of the New York Times. My next guest has a woman show opening next week at the Eureka Theater to remedy that ignorance. Terry Baum was last here to talk about her role in the Crackpot Crones Christmas show a couple of seasons ago. She's been writing plays since 1972 on issues ranging from gay and immigrant rights, anti-Semitism, and medical ethical dilemmas, to the eternal pursuit of love. Critics have compared her to her writing and performing to Woody Allen, Bea Arthur, Eve Arden, Spalding Gray, Lily Tomlin, Hunter Thompson, Norman Mailer, and Godzilla, but never in the same review, fortunately. Terry, a pleasure to welcome you back.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
And such a great timing to talk about something presidential on this Independence Day Eve.
That's right. That's right. It's a very patriotic thing to do, to out a former First Lady.
So tell us, let's first talk about how Eleanor and Lorena Hickok met.
They met because Hick was assigned. She was working for the Associated Press, and she perceived something very special in Eleanor before she knew her well at all. And she talked her boss at the AP into assigning a woman reporter to follow Eleanor around the very first time FDR ran for president in 1932. So she convinced her boss that somebody should do it, and it turned out that it was Hick. She at first really resented this assignment because she wanted to be focused on the candidate. That was a higher status. But in fact, they fell in love with each other during that campaign. So that's how they met. And you referred to some of Eleanor's accomplishments, putting herself out in public, having the first press conference as a first lady, her columns, and also she wrote many articles. And Hick was really responsible for a lot of that.
And some over 2,000 letters written between them. And we're not just talking like one or two pages. We're talking 20, 30 pages that Eleanor wrote to Lorena and vice versa.
Well, Eleanor wrote surviving because Hick burned a lot of her letters. But left are 2,336 letters from Eleanor to Lorena Hickok. And these make very clear that Eleanor was in love with Hick and they had a physical relationship. And that also after that period of the great passion was over, that they remained very deep friends until Eleanor died.
Hmm. I'm wondering if Doris Kearns Goodwin knows about these letters.
She does, and you know what she did? This is, really infuriates me. Because people just don't, they feel there's something shameful about the fact that Eleanor had a lesbian relationship. And, I mean, they don't want Eleanor to have any sex at all. You know, she presented herself as a very sexless kind of person in general to sort of defuse her power, image.
I think she famously said that she, you know, she didn't care for sex and her kids, she even told her kids that, you know, she barely had a relationship with her kids. Instead, grandma was the
I don't remember. I've read her biography, the most recent one. But this is something that Doris Kearns Goodwin did in saying that it was ambiguous whether they had a relationship or not. She elided the important, sexy part of a quote. This quote is, "Oh, I want to put my arms around you, Hick. I ache to hold you close. I can't wait to see you." But in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, it's, "Oh, I want to put my arms around you, ... I can't wait to see you." So I think she also left out, I want to put my arms around, you know. So she establishes it's ambiguous by leaving out the words of Eleanor's that make it unambiguous. And let me say, I use Eleanor's letters verbatim in my show, and I had to get the permission of the Roosevelt estate to do that. They're not in the public domain. And they gave me that permission after I told them that it was my opinion that Eleanor and Hick were in love.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So you worked with Pat Bond, the playwright, on this, or is this mostly?
Pat is long gone, but she wrote the first play on Hick, and she was a very close friend of mine. I have an excerpt from her play in my play.
Oh, I see.
So about a sixth or seventh of the play is by Pat Bond.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the show itself. Are you playing both characters, or
no,
are you just playing Lorena?
I'm playing Lorena, and it's really about the experience from Hick's point of view. Eleanor is represented by her words from the letters on tape, played by a very, very wonderful actress, Paula Barish. So Hick is talking to the audience about what she's going through and also reacting to the letters that she is reading on stage and then the audience hears over the sound system. And sometimes we have both, she's there, not playing Eleanor, but interacting with an invisible Eleanor. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little excerpt from it, then we'll talk more about this fascinating relationship.
Great. Well, this is part of the very, very beginning of the play, when they're on the campaign train together in 1932. "Today was unbelievable. Mrs. R. turned from stone into butter and asked me to have coffee with her alone in her compartment. She told me she'd always been afraid of reporters because a real lady never gets her name in the paper except for three times, when she's born, when she's married, and when she dies. So she'd been terrified to have me following her around. Then she turned to me, looked me straight in the eye, and said, 'I was wrong. I want to get to know you, Hick.' Well, I damn near dropped dead, and I had this funny feeling. I haven't felt it for so long, a kind of excitement, a kind of an uneasiness. I knew what it was, but I didn't want to admit it even to myself. But I sure as hell wired ahead to get a hotel room so I could clean up. Gotta look good. 'Careful now, Hick. Don't be a complete idiot. This woman is straight as a string, married to, for all you know, the next president of the United States. Want to get drummed out of the AP or even land in jail? Just keep it up, old girl. But it's no good. Okay, so I'm a monster, but I was born this way. I can't help it. I can't stop. I'm falling. Jesus, am I ever. We kept finding time to be together. Getting off the train one morning, all alone in a silver morning, a silver and pearl morning, I couldn't stop myself. I took her lovely, graceful hand and held it, sort of swinging it like girls do. She held on right back and tight. Well, my stomach was doing flip-flops. I could hear my heart pounding. Could she hear it too? Oh, lady, my lady, for that's what you are, whether you know it or not. Do you have any idea what a homosexual is?
Wow, that's Terry Baum reading from Hick, A Love Story, The Romance of Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt. It's from July 10th to the 27th, limited engagement, only 3 weeks at the Eureka Theater on Jackson Street. That's some powerful stuff, Terry.
Yeah, thank you. I want to remind people it's free. The performances are free. Mm-hmm. For everybody. Yeah, it's a very incredible, amazing story. Hick is an incredible person. And of course, we know how amazing Eleanor was. This is the person who was really Eleanor's very deep friend till the end of her life. Came from desperate poverty, pulled herself up by her own bootstraps to be a famous reporter, was a butch lesbian at a time when such an identity didn't exist, except it's something totally shameful and perverted. Hmm. And Eleanor went for it. To her credit, she went after her bliss. I mean, they both had so much courage. I mean, Eleanor wore to the inauguration the ring that Hick gave her.
Wow.
How subversive is that?
So how did Lorena Hickok's career change when she was actually living in the White House? She had to adjust her perception and the way she reported.
It was a disaster for her career as a journalist.
Well, let's talk about her living in the White House, first of all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that was really after she was a journalist.
Okay.
She had to, in fact, choose between Eleanor and her career as a reporter, because the AP kept on pestering her for inside information. But of course, she would have been betraying Eleanor to give that information. And finally, it was a completely untenable position. She had to quit. Mm-hmm. But then she did, after that, spend a lot of time living in the White House. Her next job was as an investigator for the Federal Relief Administration, traveling all over the country, writing reports, and which are considered, by the way, by scholars to be the best record of the Great Depression. And when she wasn't on the road, she was in the White House. She actually had a bed in the dressing room off Eleanor's bedroom. That's where she slept.
Wow.
In Eleanor's bedroom.
Wow.
Yeah. Later, during all of World War II, she lived in the White House also. A lot of people lived in the White House, but all of them were either relatives or working for the president, except for Hick. And Hick, at that time, the romance for Eleanor was over. Hick was always madly in love with Eleanor and completely devoted to her. So she no longer had a bed in the dressing room. She had the room across the hall. Hmm. And at that time, she worked for the Democratic Party, and she and Eleanor had breakfast together whenever Eleanor was at home. Eleanor was mostly on the road. And if Eleanor came in late at night, she'd wake Hick up and sit on the edge of her bed and talk.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, tell us about your personal journey towards... You obviously knew of Eleanor Roosevelt growing up as a lesbian yourself. Did your loyalty shift from becoming infatuated with her career to becoming infatuated with Lorena's career?
Well, I mean, how can you not be totally infatuated with Eleanor Roosevelt? That woman had so much courage. I mean, nobody has spoken up like she did. She's just an amazing, amazing role model. Of course, she was not a lesbian. I would say she's bisexual. Hick, I have an identity with as a lesbian, although I came out after the women's movement, when really coming out was not as difficult as Well, I mean, for Hick, there was no option. In other words, she could not go to a gay bar because she risked getting arrested and that would be the end of her career. So she had no community. This whole thing she never talked about to anybody in her whole life. Can you imagine the burden of that? Amazing, amazing.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier that you got special permission to use some of these letters.
Yeah.
How did you encounter the letters, and how much of them did you encounter?
Well, I encountered them first in, there's a biography of Lorena Hickok that has letters, and then there's actually an anthology of the letters. Hick destroyed most of hers, so it's really most. There's 1,000 letters by Hick and 2,336 by Eleanor. And then I actually went and did research at the archives in the FDR library. I had this idea that I was going to read all of Eleanor's letters and I was going to discover a letter that hadn't been published that would give me so much insight. And I was so excited by this prospect. But in fact, her handwriting is illegible. It's just impossible to decipher. And so I wasn't able to do that. But even so, it was a very thrilling experience. Some of the letters were typed, of course, not by Eleanor, by your secretary, so that was never the really hot stuff. It was a sensation of getting to know both of them much more deeply through being there, looking at ephemera. Imagine.
A picture does speak an awful lot, doesn't it?
Hick had these little calendars in which she, year after year, in which she circled every day she saw Eleanor and crossed out every day she did not see her.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's this visualization of her total, complete devotion to Eleanor.
Fascinating. It's Terry Baum starring as Lorena Hickok in Hick, A Love Story, The Romance of Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt. Free performances for 3 weeks only at the Eureka Theater. Information at both crackpotcrones.com as well as the Eureka Theater website. I should also mention, Terry, that you're going to be doing a talk about Lorena Hickok and the play on Tuesday, July 15th at the GLBT History Museum on Castro Street. And that's also free and open to the public.
Yes.
More information at crackpotcrones.com. Terry, thanks so much for coming in. It sounds like a wonderful show.
Thanks so much, David. I really enjoyed your previous guest, too.
Oh, yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
It's a fascinating group today.
Really.
Well, it being the first Thursday of the month, I'm very pleased to welcome back to our microphone stage Joshua Cosman, critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, to offer us some of his critical picks for the month of July. Welcome back, Joshua.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here. And I also enjoyed all your previous guests. So there.
Oh, good. Thank you.
This play sounds wonderful. I have to check it out. So July is always a little bit, I always expect July is going to be a little bit slower, and it's a little bit slower, but there's still plenty to take up this month for me and for others. A lot of it is operatic. The Marilla Opera Program is already underway. You know, the young kids that come through the San Francisco Opera Training Program and start really spreading their wings here in San Francisco. And they're going to start showing us their wares publicly a little bit this month. There's going to be two staged opera productions from the Marilini. The first one is kind of interesting. It's A Streetcar Named Desire, the opera based on the Tennessee Williams play written by the composer André Previn and librettist Philip Littell. This was, of course, a San Francisco Opera Commission back in 1998. Lotfi Mansouri, the former general director of the company, who had this dream for many years of turning Tennessee Williams' play into an opera, and by gosh, he did it. So that was, you know, that was a big sort of starry undertaking in '98 with Renee Fleming as Blanche Dubois, Rod Guilfrey as Stanley Kowalski, and now it seems to have taken on a new life as sort of a repertory item, at least for these young kids.
In fact, I'll have a couple of them on next week to talk about it.
Very good. I was hoping you would. I don't know any of them. They're all new names to me, but I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do with this piece. This is going to be in a new reduced orchestration with Mark Morash, who's the director of musical studies for the company, conducting, and Jose Marie Condemi, a former Marilla participant himself, will be directing. And that's July 10th and 12th at this new home that they have on Church Street and near 16th in San Francisco at the Everett Middle School. They have a little auditorium that Marilla has been using for performances.
Right.
And then the second opera of the season is a more familiar one. It's Mozart's Don Giovanni. Martin Katz, the estimable conductor and pianist and coach, will be conducting. James Darrow will be directing. Again, I could tell you the cast of singers, but we'll know more about them as the summer continues. That'll be opening July 31st and continuing again on August 2nd. I'm allowed to go into August a little bit here, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
The month police won't come down on me. That'll also be at the Everett School. And in between comes a really wonderful event, which is the Schwabacher Summer Concert. This has become a regular event during the Marilla schedule, in which it's not exactly solos and it's not exactly full operas, but it's big extended scenes from familiar operas, some Handel, some Verdi, some Rossini, a little Puccini and Bizet. And usually they're you know, big scenes that encompass two or three what we would think of as arias, and they kind of get a big chunk of the piece. And that'll be done twice. Once on the 17th, again at the Everett School, and then again on 19th outside at Yerba Buena Gardens, right over by over on Mission Street there, and that'll be a free event on Sunday the 19th. Information on all the Marilla programs is at www.marilla.org.
Merola.org. More opera on the way this month.
Sure.
It's amazing. Month for opera.
Opera's like the mammals of the ecosphere. They kind of go into the niche where things open up. The West Edge Opera, which some of us still remember as the Berkeley Opera, but is now the West Edge Opera and devoted to something a little more venturesome, they've got a three-part sort of mini festival going this summer. They're doing three very different, very interesting sounding productions in rep. One of them is La Boheme. We know La Boheme, but Mark Straczynski, who runs the company, promises me that this is going to be a weird and out there and different Boheme. I don't know yet how or why, but he'll be directing it, so something interesting will happen. And Jonathan Kuhner, who's the music director of the company, will conduct. That's going to be going in alternation with two other pieces. One is Hydrogen Jukebox, which is Philip Glass's settings of poems by Allen Ginsberg. I'm not familiar with this as a theatrical piece. I remember him doing it once in Berkeley, just sort of as a concert piece, but I've never seen it done staged. But that's going to happen. And finally, The End of the Affair, which is Jake Heggie's opera based on the Graham Greene novel. That was premiered in Houston several years ago and then went to Seattle and then kind of vanished. And this is really kind of an assertion of confidence in a piece that hasn't gotten too many of those. It hasn't fared very well since its premiere, but they seem to think they're going to make a case for it, and I'm looking forward to seeing them do it. So those are going to be running from July 26th through the middle of August at a place called Ed Roberts Campus, which is in Berkeley. The West Edge Opera has been a little bit homeless lately, unfortunately. They had a very good spot in the El Cerrito Performing Arts Theater, I guess it's called, at the El Cerrito High School. And then they got priced out of there, and they did one pro show at Berkeley Rep, and that seems to have gone well, but then there were scheduling conflicts, so they weren't able to get back in there. So they're looking for, you know, they're kind of walking around with their bindle stiff like a hobo, going from one location to another. And now they've sort of washed up at the Ed Roberts campus, which I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays.
West Edge Opera for westedgeopera.org for more information on that, especially in directing to the Ed Roberts campus. We should mention another operatic event that's happening this Saturday. I don't know if you're a fan of AT&T Park version of La Traviata.
That's true.
Social event than a...
It is. You know, and I have not actually, to my great embarrassment, I have not been there to the opera at AT&T Park. And Saturday, I'm going to be in the hall. It's a new cast, so I'm going to be reviewing the love couple, Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello, the husband and wife team, who are going to be playing the leads. And
in Giants baseball caps, no doubt.
We shall see. I wouldn't put it past David Gockley to do something just that interesting. But yes, so some of us will be in the hall. Are you going to be at the ballpark?
I'm not sure exactly what my Saturday is bringing at this point.
Okay. Well, that is something to look forward to. Either way, that's true. Either in either location, I think that'll be a lot of fun.
sfopera.com for that. Well, we need to move on to the non-operatic aspects of July.
Exactly. And one thing I want to make a plug for is a pianist named Lisa Moore, who's a terrific avant-garde pianist and vocalist, formerly a member of the Bang on a Can All-Stars and now a great solo artist in her own right. She's going to be coming in July with a solo recital playing music by Frederick Jevsky, Martin Bresnik, Philip Glass, Randy Newman, and others, a program of music combining piano and vocalism. One of the pieces that she's going to play is a piece I'm very taken with called De Profundis by Frederick Jevsky. This is a setting for pianist who plays the piano and recites the Oscar Wilde poem. You know, this is the great cry of despair that he wrote in the Reading jail when he was imprisoned. And it's about a 30-minute piece. Jevsky has performed it. Lisa Moore has recorded it very beautifully, and I thought we could listen to a little bit of it. This is her recording of Frederick Jevsky's De Profundis from a CD of hers called Which Side Are You On?
And then more with Joshua Cosman. Of the great avant-garde pianist and vocalist Lisa Moore. Thanks for sharing that, Josh.
I know, it's great,
news
isn't it?
To me. Yeah, it's fantastic.
So yeah, that, and later on in the piece, she actually does get to the words, but first there's some vocalisms. So that's on. I didn't give the date. That's July 20th. At the Center for New Music at 55 Taylor Street in San Francisco, a new venue that's been doing a lot of great programming over the last 6 or 8 months.
It's in that first block of Taylor just off of Market.
Mm-hmm. And information there is at centerfornewmusicalltogether.com. Music in a little more of a traditional vein. We've got some summer festivals coming up. The Music at Menlo Festival in the Peninsula, which starts its amazing 11th season under the directorship of pianist Wu Han and the cellist David Finkel. And each summer they have a programming theme. This summer it's going to be the music of Dvorak, which means that not only do we get Dvorak, but a lot of familiar predecessors like Mozart and Beethoven and so forth, and a lot of the Czech composers who came later, including Martinů and Bartók. That gets underway July 19th at various locations in Menlo and Atherton, and runs through August 9th. Information is Music at Menlo, and it's Music AT Menlo, although the actual name of the festival has an at sign because it's tech. Finally, I hear the music coming. This is Midsummer Mozart with the great George Cleave, marking its 40th anniversary this season with nothing but Mozart all the time. Two programs on July 19th and 20th, and then on 25th and 27th. And information on that is at midsummermozart.org.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing, Joshua.
Thanks for having
me. All the time we have.
Okay.
As we go out with some strains of Mozart's 41st Symphony. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. Our programs are archived at our website, kalw.org. You can send me a program suggestion, maybe a cultural person or organization you'd like profiled here on Open Air. Send me an email, david@kalw.org.